This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition a booming China spells trouble for America. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of May 16, 2007, and was sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation. A few words about the format. Every debate consists of an 8-minute opening speech from each panelist, followed by a discussion of questions raised by the audience. The evening concludes with short summary statements from both sides. The audience was polled on the motion, "A booming China spells trouble for America," before and after the event. The entry poll gauged the live audience as 41% in favor of the motion and only 37% against. 22% didn't know. The moderator for this live debate is James Harding, business and city editor of The Times of London and former Shanghai bureau chief for the Financial Times. Let's begin with James Harding introducing the debaters.
Let me introduce the panel to you. For the motion, firstly, we have Bill Gertz, who's the defense and national security reporter for The Washington Times, an author and a Fox News analyst. Then we have Professor John Mearsheimer, the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. And finally, Michael Pillsbury, consultant to the Office of the U.S. Secretary of Defense and advisor to the Pentagon on Asian Affairs and Long-Term Defense Planning. Against the motion, there's the founder and chairman and chief executive of McGregor & Company, an author, and the former chief executive of Dow Jones in China, James McGregor. Then we have Daniel H. Rosen, the principal of China Strategic Advisory, adjunct associate professor at Columbia University and visiting fellow with the Institute for International Economics. And Ambassador Stapleton Roy, managing director of Kissinger Associates and a 3-time ambassador serving in Singapore, the People's Republic of China, and Indonesia. Right, those were the formalities. Now let's get on with the debate, starting with Bill Gertz. Over to you.
Question before the House is, does a booming China spell trouble for America? The answer, in my view, is a resounding yes. In the next few minutes, I'm going to explain why. As the late CIA analyst and White House National Security Council official Konstantin Menges put it in his book, China, the Gathering Threat, he said, the reason that China poses a threat is because, despite its economic reforms, it is today ruled by a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship. This is the source of the trouble. To start with, the most serious trouble for America from China is China's military buildup. On January 11th of this year, China conducted an unprecedented anti-satellite missile test. They fired a missile that traveled through space and hit a low-Earth orbit satellite, a Chinese weather satellite, destroying it and creating 16,000 pieces of debris, which pose a threat to other satellites. U.S. officials were shocked by this development because U.S. intelligence estimates of China's military have been stating for years that China is 10, 15, maybe 20 years behind the United States. What the Chinese ASAT test showed was that China is not seeking to follow the U.S. missile for missile, ship for ship, submarine for submarine. They're going after niche weapons. They're trying to leap ahead with special technology. Officials in Washington estimate that within the next 6 years, China will have the capability of destroying all U.S. low Earth orbit satellites. Basically, this could be the modern-day equivalent of a space Pearl Harbor against the United States if there were a conflict over Taiwan. The danger of China expanding to gain resources is kind of a new source of trouble that has been identified by some studies in the Pentagon, one of which was called the so-called String of Pearls strategy. It shows that China is developing a string of pearls, bases, alliances, along a path going from the Middle East, where much of its oil comes from, all the way to China. There are very much concerns that because energy is so integral to China's modernization effort, that China at some point will have to expand militarily, perhaps the Russian Far East, perhaps Southeast Asia, to take over places that have valuable oil and gas resources. As for influence operations, this is another area where China has been extremely successful in influencing policies against the United States. We see this through so-called what one Chinese defector called money diplomacy, buying up former U.S. officials and using those officials to lobby against policies that China doesn't like. This is having a deleterious effect on the U.S. economy and U.S. policy because it's preventing the United States from truly understanding the directions and goals of China's military modernization and its general modernization as well. The main policy for the United States towards China has been to trade with China as a way to seek a liberalized Chinese government and political system. Unfortunately, the idea of trading with China as a liberalizing factor is not working. In fact, just the opposite is happening. Many feel that China's military buildup is being benefited by its economic growth, but yet we have seen little or no political reform in China. At its core, China has never fully resolved the Tiananmen massacre in 1989. As well, religious repression is also in this field, as well as environmental degradation. As many as 7 out of 10 Chinese major rivers are now dead. This debate has often been couched as is between engagement and containment, but really the issue here is that what China needs is democracy, and that is really the solution to mitigating these sources of trouble for the United States.
That was Bill Gertz speaking in favor of the motion. Next, an excerpt of Stapleton Roy's opening statement.
Trouble for us spells even bigger trouble for China. The advantage is on our side, not China's. 7 successive U.S. presidents over a space of 35 years have discovered that containing troubles and developing common interests with China benefits us. 3 successive generations of Chinese leaders have come to the same conclusion. Such a track record should give us confidence. China's rapid growth has created an enormous middle class concentrated in China's coastal provinces. This new middle class enjoys a level of affluence unthinkable in the 1970s. These middle class Chinese are educated, entrepreneurial, and outward-looking. They have more in common with the middle classes elsewhere in Asia than they have with the backward parts of their own country. They represent the building blocks for China's eventual transition to a more representative form of government. China's society is remarkably more open than it was before. Western-educated Chinese now occupy significant positions at all levels of government, business, and education in China, totally absent 30 years ago. In essence, China has abandoned Marxism-Leninism and class struggle in favor of market economics and promotion of a harmonious society. Obviously, as China's economy continues to grow and as its military capabilities improve, we have to consider the possibility that a more powerful and prosperous China will become a security threat. A highly nationalistic China under poor leaders or under bad leaders would pose serious problems for us and for the global community. 2 aspects are of particular concern. China's military spending has been growing at double-digit rates for the last 15 years. China's defense forces are preparing for Taiwan scenarios that include the possibility of U.S. intervention. Does this mean we should sound the alarms and assume that conflict with China is inevitable over Taiwan? The answer is no. The situation calls for vigilance, not for alarm. U.S. military leaders are not sitting on their thumbs. They are quietly confident that we can handle any challenges, and they believe that conflict can be avoided. Such confidence is warranted. We in China have developed an effective framework for managing the Taiwan issue. Both countries, the United States and China, have stated that they are opposed to unilateral changes in the status quo with respect to Taiwan. In addition, enormous common interests have developed on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, interests missing before we befriended China. It would require ineptitude on a massive scale in Beijing, Washington, and Taipei for this situation to generate into a military conflict. To conclude, an alarmist view of China exaggerates the dangers and obscures the opportunities. China's economy is now 10 times larger than it was in 1978, and our relations with China are better. China has significant...
That was an excerpt of Ambassador Stapleton Roy's opening statement. Michael Pillsbury then presented his opening statement in favor of the motion, "A Booming China Spells Trouble for America."
Thank you very much. As all of you know, here in sophisticated New York, State Department and Defense Department often don't get along. So it may come as a surprise to you, it certainly comes as a surprise to me, that I agree with every word of what Stapleton Roy just said. In fact, I believe our team wants to adopt him as a fourth member of our team because he essentially is speaking in favor of the motion as we see it. And I want to ask for your support for the motion in the way we define the two key words in the motion. The first word is beware, and we take that to mean be wary, be wary. The second key word, Bill Gertz went over, is trouble. In other words, the burden on the other team to earn your vote is to say you should not beware, you should be blithely sort of confident that there'll be no problems at all with China. They have to sustain that case. Then they have to sustain the case that there'll be no trouble from China forever. Our side doesn't have to be extreme. We don't have to be alarmist about China. We don't have to forecast an inevitable war. We don't have to say that we should break off all relations. It seems to me it should be unanimous tonight that our team is going to win. Especially since Stapleton Roy essentially is working for us. I do want to say he characterized the Defense Department's view of China quite correctly. That's very accurate. Going back for 15 years now, secretaries of...
These are excerpts from a live Intelligence Squared debate, "A Booming China Spells Trouble for America." You can listen to the event in its entirety on our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared. That was Michael Pillsbury speaking for the motion, and you'll hear more of his opening statement in just 1 minute. We now continue with opening statements from an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition, "A Booming China Spells Trouble for America." To make his case in favor of the proposition, Michael Pillsbury chronicled the turbulent history of U.S.-China relations.
But we've never gotten a pledge from China not to use force against Taiwan. We've never really gotten credit for what Henry Kissinger did. President Nixon withdrew American nuclear weapons from Taiwan. President Nixon severed the military connection. President Carter severed the fact that we kept two American generals there, one for arms supply, one to plan war with the defense of Taiwan in mind. The Chinese take that, those major concessions from us, as though they never happened. And the Chinese rhetoric today continues to talk about how the U.S., if it even sells one bullet to Taiwan, this somehow strengthens the independence forces on Taiwan. It's simply not true. We have enormous self-imposed restrictions on our arms sales to Taiwan. So across the board, we have a lack of progress in Chinese nationalistic attitudes toward America. Every department of the U.S. government has what, in my view, amounts to an aid program, a program of engagement with China. Very seldom mentioned in the Chinese press. If you're a young Chinese, you have the impression that America is trying to dismember China, that America poses a military threat, that America is working with India and Japan to somehow crush China or contain its rise. All of this nationalistic rhetoric ought to be banned in the Chinese press. We don't say these things in our press. So, to support our side of this debate, you have to be wary, that is, look for possibilities that might happen in the future where things will not be as rosy as we may have hoped, and you have to admit there's trouble. That's all we ask for our side, and I hope it will be unanimous.
That was Michael Pillsbury. Here's an excerpt of Daniel Rosen's opening statement focusing on three economic arguments against the motion.
Let me explain each of these very briefly. First of all, China's growth is benefiting the economies of rich and poor nations alike. Japan, with merely 40% of the labor force that the United States has exports $10 billion worth of goods to China every month. The United States only exports half that amount. The point of this is China is not an economy that is closed to rich world exports at all. It's very much open to them. Developing nations in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, in Africa are also benefiting in a way the World Bank couldn't have imagined a few years ago from China's dynamic growth. Even Taiwan, that's of such concern to us all here at this table, is in fact enjoying a $66 billion a year trade surplus with its arch enemy, the People's Republic of China. Taiwan, in fact, is moving away from the attitude behind the motion on the table this evening. Bottom line, our fortunes here depend on what we do, on how we compete with China, not on what China does. We should spend more time competing with Germany and Japan, in fact, for the Chinese market, and less time blaming China for all of our troubles. Second major argument I want to make: China's growth benefits its people, and by doing so, mitigates profound troubles that would eventuate if that were not the case. The real threats, the existential threats to the United States today, come from impoverished and stagnant states riven by discontent and insecurity. North Korea, Iran, Iraq, the Middle East in general. These are the engines that breed terrorism and nihilism, which are the true threat and trouble we should be concerning ourselves with. China could have been among those. By embracing our economic model, they've grown beyond that danger. And though 800 million Chinese are still poor by our standards, they're striving toward prosperity and not toward extremism. Those people, those toiling Chinese, are the boom that we're here to pass judgment on this evening. And while their toil brings competitive challenges for us, we would be gravely mistaken to try to turn back the clock to the failed state China was before this boom began. Third major argument: beyond our narrow economic interests and theirs lie global economic responsibilities that must be addressed cooperatively. The U.S. has refused to address its responsibility to carbon emissions, and the reason given? China. A convenient fits-all-purposes excuse not to act when you don't want to act. China, interestingly enough, has refused to accept carbon commitments for the same reason. The United States should go first. This logjam is fueled by the mistrust that tonight's motion puts forward. And indeed, it cannot be permitted to stand. We have an economic response.
That was Daniel Rosen. John Mearsheimer made the last opening statement for the proposers of the motion. Here's an excerpt of his argument.
The question on the table is, does a rising China spell trouble for the United States? Or in slightly different words, from an American perspective, is a powerful China likely to be bad for the United States? I think the answer is axiomatically yes. And I say this not because I feel any personal hostility towards the Chinese, which I certainly don't, or because I think China is particularly aggressive. And I don't say it because I think China is likely to behave irrationally in the future. My argument is that the best situation for the United States from the perspective of maximizing its security is to be the most powerful state in the international system. The bigger the gap between you and everybody else, the more secure you are. To put it in Pentagonese, you don't want a peer competitor in the international system. To give you two examples that highlight this point, think about the United States and its two immediate neighbors, Canada and Mexico. As you know, we are much more powerful than either one of those countries. None of you go to bed at night worrying about Canada or Mexico attacking the United States. That's simply not going to happen because we're so powerful. Same basic logic applies to China. If China has two choices, one, it can have a Japan in Asia that's five times more powerful than China, or a situation where China is five times more powerful than Japan, which one of those alternatives do you think the Chinese will choose? It's an open and shut case. And the same basic argument applies to the United States and China. And you want to understand here that it's impossible for the United States to discern what Chinese intentions will be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. We don't know what those intentions will be. In a system where you can't discern intentions and where there is no higher authority that you can turn to when you're in trouble, the best way to maximize your chances of surviving is to make sure that you are by far the most powerful state in the international system. To put it in colloquial terms, you want to be the biggest and baddest dude on the block so that nobody fools around with you. To put it in political science speak, you want to be a hegemon. Now, what is the future going to look like if, in, say, 20 years, China continues to grow economically the way it has grown over the past 20 years? What you're going to get is a country that's economically pretty close to being as strong as the United States. And you could rest assured that China is going to turn that economic might into military might. That country is going to try to dominate Asia the way the United States has successfully dominated the Western Hemisphere. They'd be fools to do otherwise. The United States will not tolerate a situation where China tries to dominate Asia. What is my bottom line here? My bottom line is straightforward. The present situation is better for the United States and more stable than a world in which China is as powerful or almost as powerful as the United States. In other words, if China rises, trouble is in store for the United States. Thank you.
That was John Mearsheimer. The final speaker against the motion is James McGregor, who cites China's internal problems as a reason not to fear its rise.
Why? Well, China has grown very fast, and it's moving very fast, but what has happened during this period? China has been shoving all kinds of problems under the carpet. The carpet's getting lumpy, and the country will trip on these problems, and it's going to be very busy for the next few decades fixing this. Environment, China is trash. 16 of the 20 worst air-polluted cities in the world are in China. I've traveled in every province of China, and I've never seen a clean body of water that was not in a bottle. Healthcare, from a fairly decent basic healthcare system, it's become very commercial. Two-thirds of people don't have healthcare. If you are a peasant and your kid gets cancer, what do? You beg, borrow, and steal money to get him to a hospital in a city. You have to deposit the money for your kid to be in that hospital. If you run out of money, they kick your kid out of that hospital. The have and the have-not issue is growing and growing. There was 80,000 demonstrations 2 years ago. Last year they went down because they realized they better not be reporting on how many they had. And on and on, party corruption, etc. So this is this colossus that's going to take on the United States. What does China really want? From a military standpoint, China wants to protect its wealth. It's been a country that's been colonized. It also wants to have the military projection to be able to protect its own sea lanes. From natural resources, China, the rocks have not been kind to China. They're as dependent as we are or more on imported oil and other materials. The government is running scared of its own people. You've got to realize when you have 10% economic growth for 20 years and kids are growing up under that kind of growth, they expect exponential improvement every year forever. And the government has really no credibility other than economic growth and giving people a better life. So where does the United States have to worry? Where do we really eclipse China? You can't be a global leader without a leading ideology, and China right now has no leading ideology other than getting rich. Right now, the United States isn't so popular around the world. China is outworking the world. But I tell you, people are looking for U.S. leadership. We will not have trouble competing with China diplomatically. Financial world, New York, you can walk down the street here and throw a rock in any direction. You're going to hit $1 trillion in hedge funds. The Shanghai banks still don't have check clearing mechanisms for private accounts. China's moving ahead in the financial world. They've got $1 trillion foreign exchange surplus, and they're, in fact, putting together a $120 billion hedge fund. But they are going to have to be dependent on the U.S. and our financial system and cooperating with us for their money to be deployed well as the capital they need. Education. The world comes to America as long as we give them the visas to have the best in the world education system. We can absorb the brains of the world and stay ahead of anybody in the world. Finally, I'm looking at my opponents here. I'm on the good guys team here on the left. And my opponents here, these are all learned men. They're all PhDs. But take a look. There's not a bit of suntan on any of those heads. They have been sitting in offices in Washington and Chicago, reading reports and putting together the world under theories, and that's quite good. I'm happy to say that. And I'm not here to defend China. I'm here to defend America, because if you vote yes, then you're voting against America. America can handle the rise of China. China's got a lot of problems, and we've handled many things in the life of this country, and we will handle this quite well. Thank you very much.
That was James McGregor. The moderator, James Harding of the Times of London, opened the Q&A portion of this debate with a couple of his own questions.
And I guess I wanted to start by directing a question at John Mearsheimer. You couldn't help but feel that Michael Pillsbury gave the game away a little bit when he said, you know, on our side of the motion, we don't need to be alarmist. We don't need to talk about war. And yet, within a few minutes' time, you were saying, the U.S. will not tolerate a situation where China tries to dominate Asia. And I guess my question is, how does China have a hope of fulfilling its promise of a peaceful rise if people like you are standing up and saying, we will not tolerate China that seeks to dominate the region in which it lives? Professor Mearsheimer.
My argument is that the United States really has no choice, because as China gets more and more powerful economically, the United States constantly bumps into the question of what China's intentions will be 10, 20, or 30 years down the road. And in a world where you have a state that's becoming increasingly powerful, nearly as powerful as you, you have to assume worst case about its intentions to protect yourself in case there is trouble. And in a very important way, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is why I titled the book that I wrote on this subject, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. This is a tragic situation. The United States simply has no choice but to assume the worst about China, and the end result is that you'll get that for sure.
I have a question also for Stapleton Roy, which is, listening to you, you can't help but fear that your position is don't worry, be happy. We have a politically unstable superpower with a foreign policy that is unclear even to itself, and clearly that is going to, at the very least, threaten U.S. preeminence in the world. And I guess my question to you is, looking back over the last 30 years, even if you take into account the benefits of engagement, has not commercial engagement with China made it more difficult for the U.S. to engage on issues from Tibet to Taiwan? And how much will the U.S. be forced to compromise its foreign policy positions if it is going to ignore the threat that China poses?
I spent my career as a diplomat, and somehow the world wasn't this Hobbesian picture that has been presented to us. If our goal is to ensure the security and prosperity of the American people in a world in which other countries have an equal right to improve the prosperity and security of their people, then we have a world in which there are common goals and in which other countries can also raise the living standards of their people and meet their security needs better. The goal then of our foreign policy is responsible behavior in the international community. That's a shared goal with most other countries, and it's an achievable goal. But it requires that we also set a good example. Now, remember also, the Western Hemisphere is the only region of the world in which one power can be the hegemon. Chinese leaders do not spend their time thinking about dominating Asia through power. The way that they are increasing their influence is through influence. So it's the country that throws its weight around that loses influence, and the country that uses its influence to promote its interests that is doing so more effectively. We ought to learn something from this. We are actually very good at playing this game when we realize that we cannot accomplish our goals or keep a peaceful world if we rely on power, as opposed to the right balance of power and influence. We certainly need to keep ourselves strong enough so a rising China does not threaten our prosperity and our security. But we don't need to do so in a world where we have to keep everybody else down because of a threat to our hegemonic position.
Thank you.
May I just say, I still consider Ambassador Roy to be the fourth member of our team. thank you very much for those comments. A balance of power is, in fact, the right approach.
Michael Pillsbury.
The next question comes from a member of the audience.
Sorry, there's a gentleman over here who has a question.
My name is Mike Endicott. This question is for Daniel Rosen. Does the example of Hong Kong and China's behavior towards Hong Kong give us any clear picture of their future intentions?
Thank you. Daniel Rosen, what does Hong Kong tell us?
Hong Kong tells us a lot. People assumed that China's reassumption of control over Hong Kong would necessarily bring a cauldron of concerns and troubles about Hong Kong's fate. In fact, things have played out entirely differently than that. China has left Hong Kong to manage its own affairs in the same way that Beijing, to a great extent, is allowing many regions of the country within mainland China to manage their own affairs. Hong Kong is prospering. Its success or failure stands on its own competitiveness. This is precisely what we should learn from the situation. The United States can benefit or be at a relative loss as a result of China's economic growth. It has everything to do with the choices we make and how we choose to respond, instead of trying to adjust our game to respond to what China wants to do instead.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to a debate on the proposition a booming China spells trouble for America. We'll return with more of the question and answer period, followed by closing statements and the results of the audience poll in just 1 minute. I'm Robert Siegel with Intelligence Squared U.S., and we'll now rejoin the debate with more questions from the audience.
Right up at the back.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Orstrom. Given Frederick Bastiat's empirically proven statement, where goods cross borders, armies won't, I'd like to ask the friendly Mr. Pillsbury if he truly believes that a wealthy China poses a greater threat than an impoverished China. Others, I think Mr. Mearsheimer clearly answered that question. I'd like to get your direct answer.
Thank you very much. So the gentleman at the back.
Hi. I guess this is for Mr. Mearsheimer. He was saying that the military strength is the key to controlling China, but it seems that we can't really do anything in Iraq to control Iraq. How are we ever going to control China? Shouldn't we focus on being economic partners with them and seek common ground rather than sort of pursue this military concept, which isn't working anywhere for us?
Thank you. And the gentleman here in the bow tie, please.
My question also is to Mr. Mearsheimer. Sorry to pile on you, but why do you believe, contrary to every example in recorded history, that the United States can continue to be the most powerful nation in the world?
Thank you for that very understanding question. let's start first, though, with a question for Michael Pillsbury about a wealthy China surely being better for America and the world than an impoverished one.
I prefer a wealthy China to a poor, angry China. I think the issue is really democracy. And a wealthy, democratic China is a better partner for us, a better ally, a better friend than even a poor, democratic China. The problem is how to get from here to there without being foolishly naive in building up China's economic strength in a way that they also maintain their nationalism, and the situation ends up that we have been gullible and naive over a 15 or 20 year period. And this has happened before. If you read John Mearsheimer's most recent book, it really chronicles a number of times this has happened in world politics. So if you really want to support our side of the resolution, you need to be thinking about this phrase the moderator used, which I love: don't worry, be happy. Because that's what their side really is advocating. I am saying be wary in the following four or five ways. We need to continue our military exchange program with the Chinese military and let them see that we're not their enemy. We don't want to call that off because don't worry, be happy. We need to continue the embargo on arms sales to China until human rights improves significantly. We should continue to do something about Taiwan's defense. We don't have to arm them to the teeth, but we shouldn't just walk away from Taiwan. And finally, we need to have technology limits on our most advanced technology that we transfer to China. Right now, it's very generous, but there are a few things we hold back, and some people say that was part of their successful test
against a satellite in space is that they had some Western technology at their service. And frankly, I don't know if all of you know, as perhaps as civilians, 90% of your military forces go through satellites, communications, intelligence. So we're a highly vulnerable society with our 400 satellites in space. This test is very serious in January, and the Chinese government, after repeated requests, has no explanation for it. They just say, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry, be happy.
Thank you very much. We'll come back in one moment. Just to John Mearsheimer, could you take on both of those questions, essentially the question of whether or not American hegemony should or can afford to continue forever?
Yeah. Very quickly on all three questions. The first one said where goods cross borders, armies don't. I think that's empirically wrong, and there was a tremendous amount of economic interdependence in Europe before World War I, and World War I still happened. And if you look at German-Soviet relations in 1941, there was actually a tremendous amount of economic intercourse, and yet you still had World War II. And in the Cold War, in fact, you had hardly any economic intercourse between the United States and the Soviet Union, and nevertheless, you never had a shooting war. Now, on the question of whether or not we could possibly contain China, and the person pointed out, how could we possibly contain China when we can't even deal with Iraq? I would note that going to war in Iraq was a completely crazy idea from the beginning, and whether or not you can fight and win in Iraq is a very different issue than whether you can contain China down the road. And the analogy I would point to that makes this quite obvious is our experience in Vietnam and at the same time our experience containing and defeating the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The Vietnam War, like the Iraq War, was a completely cockamamie idea. But nevertheless, the United States, even though it lost in Vietnam, still won the Cold War. It clearly has the wherewithal to finance the defenses to contain China down the road. And this gets to the final question, which is, can the United States remain number one forever? First of all, nothing's forever, so the United States is not going to remain number one forever. But I would be willing to bet a lot of money that the United States is actually more powerful relative to the rest of the world over the course of this century, largely for demographic reasons, than it is right now. A lot of the doomsayers.
The Q&A portion of the debate closed with a question about America's growing economic dependence on China, limiting our diplomatic options for addressing Chinese support for rogue states.
There in the blue shirt.
Thanks. This is for the speakers against the motion. You had said that China has no ideology, and yet if a booming China means that U.S. is increasingly dependent on China, and yet China has shown its interest in supporting rogue or failed states such as Sudan, and yet because of our dependence on China, that inhibits our ability to intervene in those situations. How would you respond to that?
Thank you very much.
James McGregor.
Who's dependent on whom here? Look at the no one's talking about the Chinese people and the economic ties. China's oil companies, China's banks, China's telecom companies are all listed on overseas stock exchanges. A country that is tied together that deeply and economically, and the amount of jobs that are created by the consumers in America, by the foreign companies, 60-some percent of exports from China come from foreign companies. So we're so intertwined, it just brings more stability.
But Jim McGregor, doesn't this question cut to exactly the problem? We're having two debates here this evening. On the right-hand side, you have people who are talking about foreign policy and national security. And on the left-hand side, we have people talking about economic growth and commercial opportunity. And actually, when you look at a case like Sudan, when you look at China's involvement in Zimbabwe, actually we're failing to address or engage China in constructive diplomatic work around the world.
Well, if you look at what have we done, China now is awash with money and they're looking to invest overseas. When they came to buy Unocal, which pumped, I think, 0.8% of American oil, Congress looked at this as a national security threat and pushed them away. You know, we've pushed Middle East money out of the U.S. already. They're going to China. China's now going out in the world to invest, and we're starting to push them away. This isn't the Philistines of the business community against the honorable people of the PhD world. This is commercial reality versus theory.
Thank you very much. a couple more questions. The lady up here. And there's a gentleman in a mauve shirt in the middle.
Hi, my name is Jolie Hunt. This is for James McGregor. Speaking of commercial realities, I'm very surprised that censorship hasn't come up. Companies like Google and Yahoo have to make restrictions on news and information there, and how can we compete with them? And saying that America can take it seems to be rather naive.
Thank you. Hold one moment. And this gentleman here.
Hi, my name is John Silberman. China's ability to produce goods for far less than America has caused untold numbers of our citizens to lose their jobs. Doesn't that mean that the China boom has already caused trouble for America?
Thank you very much. Okay, let's start Daniel Rosen with outsourcing.
The automobile industry was a terrible, terrible threat to the horse and buggy industry here in New York City. In fact, there's practically... We're down to about 100 people in horse and buggy now, and they're all in Central Park. The U.S., unlike almost every other great power that we've seen, has shown itself entirely open to change, to adjustment. Instead of trying to defend an increasingly uncompetitive status quo, we've found ways to innovate, to adjust, to continue to be competitive, despite the changes that necessarily take place in the world around us today. Trouble's a given. Change is a given. It's unfortunate, it's difficult for people that are faced with the immediate consequences of it, but there's really very little alternative to it. Finally, we have a 4.5% unemployment rate in this country. How much lower do we really want it to go?
Thank you.
On the commercial realities part, I'd like to get in a word there.
Sorry, Bill Gertz, yes.
Yeah, the issue of China's proliferation activities hasn't been raised, but China, as many of us know, gave nuclear technology to Pakistan. In the 80s and 90s. That nuclear technology ended up going to Libya and Iran and North Korea, and they even found Chinese language nuclear warhead design documents when they dismantled Libya's nuclear program. And they're doing this as part of a policy that's usually denied by the central government, but in reality, China is helping these rogue states with weapons technology, both missiles and weapons of mass destruction.
Thank you very much, Bill Gertz. And finally, on censorship.
On censorship, the quick answer is the Internet has changed China, and China is fighting a losing battle every day with information. You wouldn't believe what is on the blogs. Google handled it okay. Yahoo handled it terribly. What Google did is they had to be in that market. I'm glad they're in that market because they're pushing the envelope on freedom of information. And what they did is they labeled their searches that they're censored, which drove the Chinese government crazy. Yahoo, on the other hand, caved right in, gave them names of people that were using Yahoo email accounts. We have to be there. We have to be pushing for freedom of information. And it's happening. Let the Chinese people do it.
Jim McGregor, thank you very much.
In our remaining time, we'll feature a sample of the closing arguments. Here's James McGregor with his concluding speech against the motion.
Yeah, I don't really know what there is to add to this other than we really haven't been talking about the Chinese people at all. Why don't we give them a chance? The Chinese people are moving ahead very quickly. They are not idiots. They're very smart. They're pushing their government every day. We're trying to tell them you must be Democrats tomorrow. The last time they took a government system from the West, it was communism. They don't want another one of those. Give them the time to find their own way. They don't want to come and attack America. They want to come here and go to Vegas. They want to go to Colorado skiing. They want to shop on Rodeo Drive. The Chinese are joining the world. This is not a country run by monsters who are out to take over the United States. They just want to be somebody in the world. And if we handle them with some skill and some sympathy, but also tough, where they are violating international rules like proliferation and intellectual property rights, the U.S. and China can have a very good relationship. I would just like to say, please, do not tell Secretary Gates that Mr. Pillsbury, who works at the Department of Defense, has asked you to vote against America tonight. America can handle China.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim McGregor. Now, John Mearsheimer, for the motion.
Ambassador Roy made the point that Chinese leaders today don't think about dominating Asia. And I think he's correct. They don't. And the reason that they don't is because they do not have the wherewithal or anything near the wherewithal to think about dominating Asia. The question you have to ask yourself is how are the Chinese likely to think when they look something like the United States today, when they're really very, very powerful? To give you an analogy, it's like having money. I've gotten wealthier over time, which is not to say I've gotten wealthy, but I've gotten wealthier over time. I've accumulated more money. And I think about spending that money and doing things with that money in very different ways now that I have it than I did when I didn't have two nickels to rub together. And the point that I would make to you about China is that there's going to come a point in the story that we're telling up here where China is extremely powerful. And I think then it will begin to think about subjects like Taiwan very differently. Of course the Chinese don't want to pick a fight with the United States now over Taiwan. They know what would happen. They would get clobbered. But the question you have to ask yourself is, in a world where China has a huge navy, a much bigger and more efficient army, more missiles, how do you think China will then think about Taiwan and the possibility of using threats? I'd bet a lot of money that they'll think very differently, and it won't be to our advantage.
John Mearsheimer, thank you very much. Now, against the motion, Daniel Rosen.
So much has been said. Two quick concluding points. Firstly, are we confident that our institutions, our way of going about growing an economy, spending our lives, is profoundly superior, better to the way China's organized, to the problems of China we've discussed this evening? I'm confident. And thus, I'm confident that for China to match us in terms of wealth creation, prosperity over time, they'll necessarily have to move in the direction of our institutions, our way of behaving in the world. I have no doubt about that. Secondly, the problems that are existential in nature, that really threaten our welfare today, are no longer realist in nature. Maybe unfortunately. The greatest force projection on planet Earth could not stop 9/11 from taking place in this city, could it? The challenges of global environmental change, climate change, cannot be addressed in any way whatsoever with force projection. We are in trouble already. Is there trouble down the road? There's trouble here today. The question is, what evolution of China best serves our interest in addressing those troubles and minimizing the trouble our children will have to deal with, we'll have to deal with for the rest of our careers? It seems abundantly clear to me that a China stronger, more prosperous, further down the road to democracy as well, is what we want to see as we turn to address all these problems which can no longer be dealt with just by the U.S. Navy. Thanks.
Daniel Rosen, thank you very much. And now for the motion, Michael Pillsbury.
Thank you. I forgot to quote from Nancy Pelosi a little bit earlier. She was attacking President Bush last April during the visit of Hu Jintao. She said that she opposed the celebratory nature of the official visit. She said our own debt with China is growing so fast, they'll soon be making our foreign policy. She said that if President Bush kowtows to Beijing in ways that threaten our long-standing commitment to Taiwan, members of both parties in Congress will be watching. She concluded by saying the American people want an administration to show resolve in standing up to Beijing. So all of you supporters in the audience of George Bush, be sure to vote for the other team.
You're going to vote with us then, right?
Because here is Nancy Pelosi rather articulately saying, beware of the dragon, the boom in China spells trouble for America.
And that concludes our debate. The audience was polled a second time at the end of the evening on the resolution of booming China spells trouble for the U.S. This time, the speakers against the motion managed to sway the audience to their side. The final poll gauged the audience as only 37% in favor of the motion, while 59% voted against. This number was up a considerable 22 percentage points from the entry poll. At the conclusion, 6% still didn't know, and that was down from 22% before the debate. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC New York Public Radio, producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore and Edward Haber, production assistance from Scott Goldberg. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.